This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The search for the Unabomber was the most expensive manhunt in American history. My guest, John Douglas, is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He participated in the Unabomber search and drew up a psychological profile of the Unabomber based on the available evidence. He's the co-author of the new book, Unabomber, and co-author of the bestseller Mindhunter about his work tracking serial killers. You may be thinking that the FBI can't take much credit for finding the alleged Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski. After all, the FBI found him only because he was identified by his brother. But Douglas says this was part of the FBI strategy. The FBI urged the New York Times and Washington Post to publish the Unabomber's manifesto in the hopes that a friend or family member would recognize the Unabomber from his writing, as Kaczynski's brother did. As it turned out, Theodore Kaczynski's name was already in the FBI Unabomber databank. I asked Douglas why it took so long for the FBI to identify him as the alleged Unabomber.
He was in the databank, but it was just there were thousands of names in there. And what you would do is you'd put the names of professors at the various universities where the bombs took place. You put the names of students in the engineering departments and the mathematics departments. And so he was in the data bank, but that doesn't necessarily mean we would get to him, sooner or later, because still there was this mindset in the FBI in certain places that we were not looking for a college-educated, bright, white male individual, that we were in fact looking for a blue-collar airline mechanic type of individual. And I have to say that was the mindset right up to the day, in some cases, the day Kaczynski was arrested.
Well, why did you you thought it was going to be a highly educated person with academic connections, right?
Right.
So what led other people in the FBI to think that this was going to be an airline mechanic?
Because one of the devices was made in such a way that the components of the bomb told these so-called experts that the only person who would have access to these different parts of the bomb would be someone who worked in the airlines, particularly an airline mechanic. But when you look at and this is before the manifesto, when you see the bombs and how they're made and how the person has to have a background in physics, in chemistry, in mathematics, and he has to be extremely bright to be able to make these bombs, because if he isn't, these bombs are going to explode in your face, just like we lose many potential bombers every year, because they just don't have the intelligence, they don't have the personality where they can sit down at their workshop and spend hundreds of hours meticulously putting the different bomb parts together. So there was a kind of a tug of war going on as far as, you know, which is it, a college educated or is it a blue collar? But once the manifesto, even then, when that was published and we saw the writings, the group of us in the behavioral science side, the ones that were still in the bureau, those of us who now were retired, I mean, there's no way that this is going to be a blue collar type of subject.
Let's hear your psycholinguistic analysis of the Unabomber manifesto. What are some of the key parts in the content and language?
One of the things that rang true, and what I told people when you do an analysis like this, you don't hold the document 3 inches from your nose. You hold a document like that 3 feet from your nose. And therefore, don't try to figure out every little nuance. For example, the initials FC, which he says stood for the Freedom Club. I mean, who knows? Early on, we had the initials FC etched in those bombs. I mean, people took hours, days, hundreds of hours trying to figure it out. Who knows what it means? It really doesn't mean anything. I remember interviewing David Berkowitz, the son of Sam, and on the bottom of his letters that he wrote to Detective Joe Borelli, the New York City Police Department, when he was terrorizing New York City, he had this little logo down there, and they brought in these psychologists, and he said, oh, look at the loops of these logos. It looks like the breast of a woman, and that's the problem that he has. He has this latent hostility. Well, when I interviewed Berkowitz at Attica Penitentiary, I said, hey, David, I said, what about this logo down here? What does this mean? He says, well, it looks good. It looks pretty good. Is that it? Doesn't mean any deep significance. So when you get back to the manifesto, one of the things that you do is you skip over the ideology. You skip over that, and what the pattern is are words like inferiority, low self-esteem. There's words of depression and inadequacies, inferiority. And that kind of rings true throughout that whole document. And what you're dealing with is a paranoid individual. And typically, paranoid individuals, what they do is they project their blame, like he was doing, projecting the blame onto society and into technology. He was really describing himself, this inadequate nobody who for the first time has become a somebody. In fact, there was a time after the Oklahoma City bombings, if you recall, 5 days later, we had another bomb from the Unabomber. He believed, is my opinion, that he was upstaged by this inadequate nobody was upstaged by someone who made a bigger, more powerful bomb. So he just wanted to show us that, hey, I'm back in business.
You talk about the recurring theme of inferiority, lack of self-esteem, and he addresses that directly in the manifesto. There's a little chapter called Feelings of Inferiority. He writes, he's actually referring to the psychology of modern leftism. Can you explain that, what he's talking about there?
Well, what he's trying to do is he's trying to convince us that it's these other people, the people from the technology types of people, the people are the involved in genetics. These are the people that in their profession are the ones that have this low self-esteem. They're inferior, and they're the ones who are controlling a society for us. We have no say. We're bringing up children, pushing them into mathematics, pushing them to the sciences, and basically programming them to be something that they really don't want to be, and that's that theme runs throughout that manifesto as well. And when you start looking now in retrospect into the background of this individual, it appears this is the way he was as a young kid growing up, educated by two parents, not educated but very interested in having the children educated, and would read very scientific books to them, were very strong, pushing them academically. And it appears that he went to Harvard, graduated in 2 years, went on to school, and he has this animosity. He's the one who has these feelings of inferiority. Here he is in college, 19 years of age. He never had a date. Even when he graduated from high school, he graduated after 2 years in high school. Never was with his peers, never socialized. And really, one of the things I found with violent offenders, period, is they have some type of physical handicap or disability. I remember doing a case in California. The subject was a serial murderer, rapist, and he had a speech impediment. And another individual I had as a child developed polio, and he received the wrong vaccine. He had this hatred, this anger for people. That pushed him forward into becoming a violent offender. This individual, his handicap could have very well has been his high IQ. His IQ is between 160 and 170. When his father's friend, who was a psychologist, tested him when he was only 5 or 6 years of age. And because of that high IQ, it just kind of made him the odd man out, and he just did not fit in with anyone. So my point is, when you read any readings from a person like this, they are projecting feelings to someone else, what these other people like, but really they're describing themselves.
What type of personality writes manifestos when they're committing crimes?
Okay, the type of person that writes, first of all, is telling us that he feels much more comfortable using this form of communication. So people like this are not the type of people you could see standing up on a soapbox on a campus ranting and raving about some social issue. This person expresses himself by writing letters to newspapers, by writing letters to his congressmen, congresswomen, and therefore, from an investigator, when you finally come up with a suspect, you will in fact find copies of the original manifestos. You'll find diaries and digest, which will set forth his plan, the plan that he had for years and years of what he really wanted to do in society. In his case, was to make bombs and hurt people.
Is the manifesto type of bomber such the loner that the manifesto, the communique, is one of the rare forms of communication he has with the outside world?
Right. The communique is the only way that these people will communicate. But then what happens is they generally start off writing communiques to the newspapers signing their real names. But as they get older, they get worse. And as they get into their late 30s and 40s and they feel like no one is paying attention to them, and that's when you begin to see some triggering mechanism that now they say, it's not worth it anymore. I'm going to get the recognition. I'm going to get the attention that I'm looking for here. And I'm going to start committing some crimes. In his case, it was a bomber. I see the same things with certain arsonists, certain rapists, and certain other forms of murderers.
My guest is John Douglas. He's a retired FBI expert on criminal personality profiling. He worked on the Unabomber investigation and has written a new book called Unabomber. Let's take a short break and then I'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with retired FBI agent John Douglas, who's just written a new book called Unabomber. What were the first questions you asked when you joined the Unabomber investigation?
What I wanted to know was with what is going on within the city of Chicago, because I knew that the subject had to be from the Chicago area, which was really a thorny issue years later when the investigation left the Chicago area, because I always believed you better stay in that Chicago area because that's where you're going to catch them. So I wanted to find out what's going on politically, socially in the city, and there really wasn't too much there as far as information that could have caused him to send these bombs. Plus, you know, why these victims? So you do a background of each of the victims, and you really couldn't find any kind of a thread of anything mutual about them that would link these victims together. You had airline people, and you had university professors. So I said, Tom, I said, this appears to be a crime with no apparent motive. And when you have a crime that where there's no apparent motive, we have to look proactively. And a person who sends bombs like this generally follows up his victims. So, you know, he may inject himself into the investigation. And I began suggesting some proactive techniques, but really most of it fell on deaf ears.
What were you suggesting?
I just wanted, even then, was to release information relative to pre-offense behavior patterns. You know, where did this person come from? He didn't come from out of space. What was he like as a kid growing up? What was he like leading up to these bombs? He had to be making bombs. He had to be experimenting with these devices. There has to be complaints filed against him. So let's release that, and let's release post-offense behavior patterns, which I believe someone would recognize those patterns as well, as someone who's extremely obsessed with the investigation, who is following the press, and he's clipping out newspaper clippings. And those are kind of the things I was suggesting to the task force, but there wasn't much done.
You say in criminal personality profiling that the earliest crimes are usually the most telling. Why is that, and does that apply to the Unabomber?
Right. When you look at a series of cases, and it's important to understand which really is the first case. Are we getting all the cases of the Unabomber, of the rapist, of the murderer, whatever? The first case tells all, because the first case, the nature of the beast, the nature of the offender is to perpetrate a crime in an area where he feels the most comfortable. And those are generally areas where he lives or where he's is employed. Later on, he'll branch out of that common area and go off to other areas in the city or in the United States. But he has a tendency to come back and gravitate back to that area. And that's where you're going to catch him, because that's where, you know, he's just starting out. He's going to have some flaws in his modus operandi until he begins to perfect it. And that's when you should be much more public with information, because people will recognize the traits and characteristics and patterns that you're giving them. Years later, it's just going to be a very, you know, faint memory of what took place, say, 18 years earlier.
Now, you mentioned earlier that you thought one of the dead ends that the FBI pursued was looking for somebody who was an airline mechanic. They thought the Unabomber was going to be an airline mechanic. What are other dead ends that you think the FBI pursued in the really long Unabomber investigation?
One of the bombs had there was a note in one of the bombs, and through indented writing, That means that it appeared that the Unabomber wrote on a piece of paper, and there was this faint impression, and it was the name Nathan R., Wednesday, 7 a.m. And so the FBI looked, and it was a lead we had to do, but we went through over 20,000 different Nathan R's looking for the Nathan R. But really, what should have been done, and we knew this, and behavioralists knew this, is that we were looking here at someone who was staging, once again, staging the scene. This person had too much intellect to make a mistake like that. I mean, here's an individual, after he makes his bombs, he tells us in his writings, he would wipe down the bombs with oil to obliterate any possibility of obtaining any fingerprints off of them. So he threw us really a red herring. And so that was, that took, I don't know how many thousands of investigative man hours to come up with no information.
Was the Unabomber a particularly difficult case for any reason? I mean, what made it such a difficult case?
I don't think it really does not have to be a difficult case. You know, sure, in 1980, my unit was just getting going and the type of work I was doing. But certainly by 1985, I and others began to have the very good reputation. And if they'd only would listen to us and balance what we're saying. We saw the same problem in Waco, Texas. And as you know, after the Waco fiasco out there, there was a total reorganization within the FBI so that the behavioral guys like myself and my people were going to have an equal voice in the decision-making process. We never had an equal voice. We're sitting outside the door, you know, and waiting for our turn to give our piece of information, but you're dealing in bureaucracy, you're dealing in an agency that was pretty much in the 1980s, pretty much ex-military guys, and strictly they see black and whites, they don't see any shades of gray, and it's like the Ephraim Zimbalist or the Joe Friday, just the facts, ma'am. And when you get a guy who's behavioral science, they look at us as, oh, these touchy-feely guys, what do they know? But we know a hell of a lot, and we've had a tremendous success rate over the years. They just have to listen to us and once in a while.
Have you spoken with Kaczynski, the alleged Unabomber?
No, I haven't, but he would be. He would be an excellent one to, to interview. These type of people would be very difficult to interview because what you'll find is that they have difficulty looking at you in the eye. He would prefer, and I know this, he would prefer expressing himself in the written form of communication. So for him to sit down across the table from me and to talk to me, it'll be very difficult. So I would give him a piece of paper and have him write out his feelings and his thoughts, and I would probably try to avoid eye contact with him because they get really antsy when you look at him straight in the eye.
Would you try to play up to his ego? Would you try to flatter him?
Usually assassin types and these types of murderers, the ones that I interviewed, they don't like that. You think they would, but they don't like that.
They can see through it?
Yeah, they can see through that. The typical kind of a killer, serial killer, rapist, they're angry as people. And I'm not saying that he's not angry, but you can do that with them. But these particular types, they can see right through that. He's a very depressed individual, and I know they have a suicide watch on him, which I think is very, very good, because I will be very surprised if he does not attempt to take his life.
Why?
Because a person like this needs control. He wants control. He was in control. He was isolated. He was off by himself. And now what have we done? Now we've put him in a cell, and of course everyone says he's doing well. He's shooting baskets. He's doing some push-ups. He's eating 3 square meals a day. But you better not turn your head too long, and because he'll study the patterns of the security when they're not watching him 24 hours a day, every minute of the day. And a person like this, I would suspect, would attempt to take his life. I cannot imagine or visualize him going to court and standing up and ranting and raving. This has not been his personality.
What is the thing you'd most like to know now about Kaczynski?
I would really like to know specifically the precipitating factor or event that really triggered him. Generally, it is some. It has to do with interpersonal relations. What I found in the past, and I just want to see if that was true with him, that caused him to send and create that first bomb. I know he was in a somewhat of a relationship there, but that relationship terminated. And I know he was having problems, difficulties at home in Chicago with the family. But there had to be something that really precipitated that. I'd also want to know if he injected himself into the investigation for future cases, because I have seen that in the past where people will maybe hang around the investigation, provide bogus information. I'd like to know if he did in fact follow the cases very closely. Did he stick around town after the bombings? Did he go to the public libraries? And I guess we'll know that, whether or not he kept a scrapbook. I suspect that he would, in fact, kept a scrapbook of all the different bombings. But, those would be a few of the things I'd like to know.
John Douglas, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
John Douglas is co-author of the new book, Unabomber. He's the former director of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.